by terrorizing these migrants and by making EU borders into Africa and expanding EU borders further and further away from the European masses, it makes them invisible. And in that, in its own way, it asks the question of what is at stake for European peace.
Hi, and welcome to the third episode of Peace in a Pod. I'm your host Keshav, and today we're going to be talking about a very interesting, if slightly broad, topic of European peace. In this episode, we have a fascinating conversation with two Masters in International Affairs researchers and colleagues at the Graduate Institute in Geneva, Arthur Luzenti and Zachary Alvarado. When we speak of European peace in contemporary security politics, we often take an outward-looking approach. By that, I mean how Europe acts abroad and how its actions affect peace around the world. And this is mainly because of the relative peace that Europe has experienced since the end of the Second World War, what is today called Pax Europia. And since the creation of the European Union in 1993, this peace has largely been institutionalized as well. The idea that a European continent that will cooperate more amongst itself will be more peaceful has largely been a success story. However, the world wars were a long time ago. And since the turn of the century, we see that Europe is once again in the middle of a wide variety of threats, both from within and from outside. And these threats affect Europe's own perception of peace, its own perception of itself, and as a result, influences its actions abroad. We see this in the annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the European response to it, to the Greek migration crisis of 2015. And some observers argue, even in Brexit, we see emerging security challenges that deserve more research. So today, we look at one such research project undertaken with the Geneva Peacebuilding Platform that I also have been fortunate to be a part of. The paper is titled Conceptions of Peace and Security in Contemporary Europe. And we explore six cases of study: Germany, France, the United Kingdom, Sweden, Spain, and Ukraine. This research project was undertaken with a cross-disciplinary approach and with nearly 24 interviews with security experts from across Europe. And today in this episode, we attempt to explore this paper and we attempt to understand this very fascinating continent. Arthur, Zach and I, we brought our own diverse perspectives to the table as both insiders and outsiders to Europe. And it made for a very interesting research experience. So hopefully by the end of this somewhat long conversation, we can effectively explain what we uncovered in our research and explore the conceptions of peace and security in Europe together. With that said, here's Arthur and Zach. Zach and Arthur, thank you so much for being a part of Peace in a Pod.
Thank you so much, Keshav.
Thanks, Keshav.
So let's just jump right into our cases of study and our research. So my first question is to Arthur. Arthur, so the research, the paper looks very interesting, and it was a pleasure to work with you on this. Could you just introduce our research to the audience a bit?
Yeah, sure. The name is Conception of Peace and Security in Contemporary Europe, Probing Possibilities for Peace Building in 2020 and Beyond. So as we are part of the Master in International Affairs, we wanted to focus a bit on the question regarding peace and security and the state of affairs of peace and security in Europe. Because in most of the literature we had to read for our classes, Europe is not really a case of studies nowadays, because a great emphasis is put on other parts of the world, such as Asia, Africa, even North America. So we wanted to, you know, challenge a bit the common understandings on Europe and security, and see what could be done and what has been done in the last decades.
Zach, let's just talk about the experience of conducting these interviews and this research, because for me it was very unique, because I got the opportunity to talk to experts from across the continent and just engage on their terms about what they feel are conceptions of European peace and security. So how was your experience like when you were doing these interviews, and what would you say would be your key takeaways for researchers who might want to continue on this research
Yeah, thanks, Keshav. I think it was an amazing experience being able to, like you said, talk with European experts across the continent. For me, it was a very enlightening and very productive time to talk with the numerous experts. We, with the help of the Geneva Peacebuilding Platform, we were able to connect with varieties of different actors, including some NGOs, just in general conversations with experts across, particularly my issue with Ukraine and Spain and different migration issues. And many of them were just incredibly helpful. They were incredibly knowledgeable, and they're very open to conversations, even if we did cold emails or cold calls to just open up the door. For me, it was very interesting to see the differences and the nuances in how they approached the project, depending on the work that they did. So whether they were mediators or whether they were interlocutors, it really was able to see the differences and the nuances in the ways that they viewed the problem, depending on their role and their job. So it was very interesting in that way. And to move on, for people who may want to study this, I really recommend going deep into these organizations, into local and non-governmental institutions across whatever country or issue that you may be looking to, because oftentimes they're the ones that are on the ground that have the most meat, I would say. To these issues, they have a particular sense of the problem and of the issue, and it's very enlightening to see.
I completely agree with that. I feel just hearing them speak from their, you know, years and decades of experience was personally a very enlightening experience. Arthur, what was your experience like?
I think kind of the same as Zachary mentioned. It was very interesting to interview people from different fields, especially when we interviewed people from the academic field. We saw that their theoretical background was very helpful for our research, and it gave us, I think it opened very interesting doors for our research. And on the other hand, it was also very fruitful to talk to, as Zach mentioned, people that worked in the field. For example, as Zach mentioned, people in Ukraine. I talked also to a few people from the Swiss Federal Foreign Affairs Service. So it was also very cool to have their insights.
That sounds great. Let's talk a bit more about the crux of our study, and let's look at it from a macro perspective. Zach, again, I'll come to you for this question. So, you know, one of the primary objectives that we wanted to understand through this study was what are the conceptions of peace and security in Europe? And I think it would be safe to say that we have a better understanding now than when we began the project. So what did you discover were the conceptions of peace and security in Europe?
I mean, generally looking at it in a macro level, we saw that it really does vary by regions and by specific levels of power. I mean, within our report, you can see that we kind of divided our cases of study by the larger powers, middle powers, and the smaller powers. And a lot of what influences their idea of security also depends on the historical, the geopolitical senses, and also a broadening of, I mean, our own ideas of what peace and security can mean. I mean, we touched upon topics of migration, of internally displaced persons, of general security frameworks of NATO and the EU, which are entrenched within European security. And we had to take a more nuanced idea of these topics into Europe to really understand what does it mean in this day and age. I mean, I found that it was more, for me personally, more human security centered. There were issues of racism, of migration issues, and of these other ideas. And it really proliferates throughout society, and how do we treat individuals? And it led to broader issues of how do you create a better society for people, and what are the institutions that actually keep us safe? And there's such a large framework of analysis and such an architecture around it that it was very fascinating to see. And I think that when people read this report, they'll see that there is such a diversity from country to country. And even though many of these countries may be in NATO and the EU, that each one defines certain objectives differently. I think there's still so much to be said about many of the issues that we discussed and that we touched upon, but I hope that our research is able to at least shift the idea of peace and security in one way for future researchers and future academics to eventually delve into. And I hope that this contributes to that.
Arthur, so what we found through our research, which was very interesting to me, was not just how Europe acts in the world itself, but how the world acts on Europe and through Europe in many ways. So my question, and I know this is one area that you are very passionate about, and I've had good conversations about this topic with you. So what role do you think traditional great powers like a resurgent Russia or the Americans have since the Cold War, and how has that changed when they deal with Europe?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think there is an ongoing debate on this. As we faced during our study, one of the main problems in talking about Europe is how we define Europe, right? Is it only the great powers such as, you know, Western Europe, the UK, France, Germany? Does it also involve Russia or the Baltic states or even the Balkans, that kind of countries? I think it's an ongoing debate, and I think at least since the end of the Second World War, there is kind of a flu artistic about what Europe is. And the fact that actually the superpower struggles of the Cold War was taking place in Europe is also a factor that complexified the whole reading grid. So I would say that in Europe in general, and as we saw in our study, there is different several kind of layers of understanding. You can of course pay attention to the great institutional framework of European security, which involves, as Zach mentioned before, NATO, the EU, also to a certain extent, the OSCE or the Council of Europe. And actually this security framework is incredibly dense in comparison to other continents such as Asia, where you don't have codes of conduct, you don't have such a dense institutional framework. Of course, it's difficult to link these different layers, because in the end, even if the European Union is a supranational institution, I mean, in 2020, it doesn't have a real defense and security service. That's so fair. In the end, it still depends on the national countries. And in this regard, what I found interesting in the work we conducted was that in a lot of cases, great powers are willing to cooperate. For example, there is a growing cooperation between the French and the German.
Zach, just following up on that, I am personally very curious about what your perspective was after everything was done, after all our research was complete, because you are from the US, and you know, in this study we talk about the Americans a lot and in a lot of detail at many points. What was your perspective as an American to look at, you know, how the Americans have acted in European security, what sort of a force they have exerted? Do you have any input about that?
Well, I think being an American, it was important to realize that my country has had a large extent into the foundations of what we consider Europe today after World War II, with NATO, with EU, with a lot of the security apparatuses and global architecture that we see today. It was interesting to see. I mean, it was trying to take my country from a European perspective, and most of my education, it obviously came from a very US-centric kind of view.
Yeah.
So it was enlightening, and it was refreshing in many ways to study it through the eyes of Arthur, through you, and through other individuals that we encountered throughout our research. And I do believe that the US does play an important role, and it shouldn't be neglected, but I also think that we should take into account Europeans' own agency as actors.
So let's speak a bit about the cases of study that we had. So I'll just explain a bit what our rationale was when we were selecting these cases of study. So of course, we wanted to accommodate as many diverse perspectives and actors as we could, considering our limitations on, you know, human resource. And of course, we want to look at the actions of the main actors and also certain conflict areas within Europe. And we wanted to provide, say, a jump-off point to any research that might want to elaborate on this or look at other cases of study. So that was the broad idea of selecting the cases of study that we did, which again are Germany, France, the UK, Sweden, Spain, and Ukraine. So Zach, I will come to you again to start off with our cases of study. Of course, arguably, your cases of study Spain and Ukraine are on the front lines of any conversation that we have about, you know, European peace, European security. So what was your experience like? And could you like just tell us a bit of the key takeaways from your cases of study?
Absolutely. So I'll first start with Spain. So we chose Spain due to it being a Southern European nation, but we wanted to focus on a nation that oftentimes wasn't as mentioned as maybe Italy or Greece, but that we believe still had a lot to say on the issue of migration and what these other Southern European nations were going through at this time. And it ended up being a very interesting case study, particularly due to the two Spanish cities of Ceuta and Melilla in Northern Africa that really are at the front line of the securitization of borders within Europe and the EU, essentially. And I mean, it was incredibly interesting just because of the parallels I was able to see, at least from Spain and the US, in the ways that they were creating vallas, or these barriers, which were like 6-meter triple wired fencing around these cities to guard off against migrants or refugees that were trying to get into Spanish territory. And I mean, these kinds of tactics you can see within Greece and Bulgaria and Hungary, as well as the United States. But it was very interesting just due to the geopolitical significance of these two cities. And then the work that the Spain and the EU would have with Morocco to stop or to hinder the arrival of these migrants. I mean, in 2019 alone, Morocco prevented around 74,000 migrants from entering these two cities, right? So these are intense numbers, and you could see migrants doing insane things to try to get in and using almost military type of tactics to try to go over these fences in these areas. And this kind of securitization of the border, as I know from my own experience in the States, just increases the danger for migrants. And in many ways, it opens up legal questions for them as human beings, for their legal rights and for jobs and for health and for their own security. And by terrorizing these migrants and by making EU borders into Africa and expanding EU borders further and further away from the European masses, it makes them invisible. And in that, in its own way, it asks the question of what is at stake for European peace? Whose peace and whose other security and whose other rights are at stake in order to guarantee the so-called peace and security of these nations? And for Ukraine, I kind of continued this idea of migration and the people. And I looked specifically at the human security dimensions and internally displaced persons. And we kind of decided on this lens due to Ukraine being a great power center. I mean, there are issues of Russia and the US and the EU, and many different forces are pulling at the edges in this country. And that's oftentimes known. So we wanted to kind of take a different approach, one that can be used by peace builders. How can they affect change on the ground now, even if Russia will decide to continue this conflict? And for that was very illuminating as well, to understand the conditions of internally displaced persons within Ukraine. I mean, as of right now, there's nearly 1.5 million individuals in the Ukrainian government just simply is unable to take care of these individuals. There's very little information, resources for them to understand where to go, how to do any administrative or health concerns. And oftentimes their rights as IDPs often make the situation worse for them. They can become targets of discrimination of like through the administrative process as well as through their host community. And it's looking at these human connections and how to change the mentality, the hearts and minds of Ukrainians to then be able to find a lasting peace process. And as we mentioned in the report, I think it will also require that IDPs, their issues must be addressed throughout all levels of negotiation in order for any lasting peace to really emerge in Ukraine. And these concerns must be met. And unfortunately, like, there's not a very hopeful turn right now due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Things have just really gotten worse for them. They are oftentimes in situations and jobs and living situations that force them to be more vulnerable to COVID-19.
Absolutely. Arthur, of course, your cases of study, which were France and Germany, they are traditional great powers. They're also great powers today, and they have significant influence in European politics and to a certain extent in world politics as well. So could you tell us a bit about your takeaways from your thesis of study?
So, for the case of Germany, I think this case of study is relevant because there was a large review of the German strategic posture and strategy since 2016, and especially since President Trump joined office. So Germany largely shook off from its passivity and adopted a more dynamic foreign policy, but always through the multilateral institutions such as the OSCE, the EU, or NATO. And it really emphasized on this understanding of Sicherheitsgemeinschaft, that is a common security understanding. And there is a large acknowledgement that the German population, its political stability, its economic dynamism, should make it preeminent leader in Europe and also on strategic issues. And I think in this regard, the 2014 Russian seizure of Crimea and the war in the Donbas was kind of a wake-up call for the German foreign policy establishment. But nevertheless, there is also a large consensus within the German population that there is kind of a pacifist and anti-militarist stance that lasts since at least the 1950s and 60s. So that was also interesting to see the civilian dimension of security understanding of Germany. In addition to this, Germany is kind of interesting because it is quite ambiguous on several issues on the European continent. For example, it is quite ambiguous towards Russia, because there is a strong adversity towards Russia on the political issues. I think we all remember the Navalny poisoning that rang the bell in Berlin.
Yeah.
And also, on the other hand, there is a great accommodation in economic matters. So, for example, Germany is committed to this Nord Stream 2 pipeline construction with Russia, which is, by the way, a great problem for the American-German relationship. So kind of ambiguous, very interesting to see the further development of these issues. And I would say for the case of Germany, what is also very relevant is the emphasis put on internal peace and counterterrorism. In the 1970s, there were actually communist extreme left groups such as the Rote Armee Fraktion that were openly contesting the German state's authority. And today there is also a great deal of problem with jihadist and neo-Nazi groups. And what was interesting to say was that Germany actually tried to deepen the European integration to solve these problems, and especially with France. And I would say the last point that I found really, really interesting, Germany has also seen environmental matters as intrinsically linked to security issues.
Arthur, before you move on to France, I have a question for you. So, of course, Angela Merkel, who's the Chancellor of Germany, she has, you know, led Germany through very shaky times, very uncertain times as well. But she announced that she's going to be stepping down next year. So what do you think about that, and what does that entail for Europe and for Germany as the leader of Europe?
So, of course, Madame Merkel was very important in this dynamic of rethinking the strategic position of Germany, especially in the last decade. But I think in Germany, there is a kind of a multi-partisan consensus about the need for Germany to kind of step up, especially in times where the American commitment to Europe is kind of shaky. Maybe it will change with the Biden administration, but still. And I think the ruling party in Germany, so the CSU-CDU, will remain in power. And I think in this regard, we will see the same trends in Germany and European security in the foreseeable future. So what my forecast will be is that we will see Germany even more engaged in European integration, and especially in terms of security and environmental issues. France was my second case of study, and as Germany was I mean, I think it's relevant by itself because it's one of the great power of Europe. So France is interesting because on the contrary of Germany, it is a great power in a way that wants to pursue a great power agenda. And this lasts since basically Napoleon, in a way. So there is in France also a great civilian and political consensus about this need to safeguard this great power legacy and pursue it. And this is also, this is quite obvious by the fact that France is really willing to invest in its nuclear capabilities to modernize its force de frappe. Also, France is willing to deepen its security arrangements with a dozen of countries worldwide, for example, Qatar, Djibouti, and a lot of Francophone African countries. France is also really willing to use its soft power tools to take back the conception of soft power from Joseph Nye, because in a way, in this regard, it is still a great power. When we think about, for example, the Organisation de la Francophonie that gathers 57 member states across the world. Yeah. And in many ways, France still have a lot of prerogatives in the economic issues and social control on these countries. For example, it is also, I think, in geostrategic terms, France will insist on its kind of safeguarded zones of influence, such as Mali, the Mediterranean region, the MENA region. And also another important point is that France will really focus on the Franco-German integration. And that is probably even more important from the French side than on the German side, because France has bet on this kind of special relationship since 73 and the Treaty of l'Élysée. And we see that today there is a deepening, strengthening of this relation in basically all of the security fields. So it goes from environmental issues to military issues. And in 2020 was ratified the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle that will further deepen this Franco-German collaboration. To conclude, I would say that France is also interested in the kind of ecological transition. And in this regard, President Macron had a very tough stance on and a very thorough will on the Green New Deal, European Green New Deal. And I think that also goes along with the Franco-German collaboration. And there is also an important process of securitization of ecology in general in the French understanding of security. Those are ongoing trends that will also continue to develop in the foreseeable future, I guess.
Thanks, Arthur. I'll talk a bit about my cases of study as well. So my cases of study were Sweden and the UK. And Sweden was a very interesting case because it's a Nordic country. It itself does not consider itself part of traditional Europe or traditional European security. And so Sweden has historically operated its security politics with a three-pronged approach. So it's non-alignment, independence and neutrality, and being a buffer between NATO and Warsaw. That is how Sweden has historically operated its relationships. But post-Cold War, it started to change things because there was a reduction in conflict and simultaneously there was a reduction in budget, in spending, which has changed now because they see a resurgent Russia, which is actively hostile towards the Swedes. So now, of course, they have an inside-out approach, which is they project force, they also cooperate internationally, but all of that serves the means of protecting national sovereignty. So the Nordic cooperation comes to mind, with Finland, Norway, and Sweden being three pillars. And the way they do that is through bilateral or trilateral exercises, military exercises, through interoperability treaties, and through sub-regional forums like the Nordefco, which is increasingly a very interesting actor in Nordic security. The areas to watch, which I am borrowing from Arthur, would be Nordic cooperation itself, because four countries in the Nordic region act in a very collective manner, which is, of course, for their own self-preservation, but it's very interesting. and the civil military sector in security sector in Sweden, which includes actors like Saab, which produce vehicles, which produce cars, but also produce military technology. As for the UK, whenever you try and understand the UK, you have to understand it in relation of the British Empire, which means that they have a desire to have a favorable international security paradigm, but they don't necessarily have the power that do that. And the holy grail of UK security documents is the Strategic Defense and Security Review, which implements the strategy that the UK defense and security apparatus has. So the two things that they that are very interesting to look at are that they want to implement cost-saving technological innovations, which points towards remote warfare, because they don't necessarily have the budget to deploy abroad, but they also have the desire to deploy abroad. So it's a very fine balance. And they categorically mention Russia as a resurgent threat and an emerging China as another threat. So these are the two very important points that that we were able to find in our study. And the UK has been a reliable member of NATO, of course, because it relies on NATO and the Americans for its own security. But one international institution, multilateral institution, that has a complicated relation with the British now is the EU. And the EU, which, of course, has a soft power dimension with sanctions, with the UK will, of course, miss out on that once Brexit is formalized. But the other important security dimension of Brexit is the crisis of Northern Ireland, which, because of Brexit, jeopardizes the Good Friday Agreement of 1988 and threatens a very fragile and a very tense peace that has been in the region for a few decades now. Another thing that we see because of Brexit is the importance that the British give to E3 cooperation, which is cooperation between France, Germany, and the UK. One example of this would be the INSTEX Agreement, which tries to compensate for the JCPOA and tries to expand on European and Iranian trade and circumvent the sanctions that the Americans have imposed. One thing peace builders need to watch out for is how Brexit influences the Northern Ireland situation. Potentially, even the Scottish referendum that happened in 2015 was also very fragile and very narrow. So that is something that we should watch out for. And of course, the recent American elections with the Biden administration, you might hope for a return to more amicable US-UK relations, but that is also what we need to watch for.
Keshav, I had a question because you made a very interesting point regarding the E3 cooperation. So would you say that now that we are almost sure that Biden is going to be the president, the next president of the United States, would you say that a deeper tie with NATO from the British point of view is possible simultaneously with this E3 cooperation? Or are these two kind of a binary choice?
So the conversation I had with a security expert in Britain was very enlightening that way, because, you know, we are generally under the impression that the Americans are retreating and the Americans no longer want to interfere in European relations. But what this particular security expert told me was that this is often overblown. And, you know, just because there's an emerging China, a counterpole to the US, that doesn't necessarily mean that the Americans are just disappearing in thin air. The Americans are going to continue to exert influence. And after, of course, you and I have had this great conversation where we try to see what a more engaging Asia-Pacific strategy might mean for the Europeans from an American perspective. And I think that is very important to look at, because Biden is, of course, an institutionalist, and he respects traditional alliances, he respects NATO allies. So I think even though we might have a strengthening of NATO alliances, I think the E3 cooperation is not going anywhere. Zach, on a similar note, I wanted to ask you a question about Spain. So you very astutely observed that the cases of studies are often emblematic of bigger issues in Europe. My question is about something that you had written in the research paper, which is Spain saw these spikes in migration refugees coming in 2017 and 2018. And it was not as big as what, say, Greece faced, but it was still pretty significant for the Spanish people. What we saw immediately after, as you pointed out, was the emergence of right-wing parties like the Vox Party. Do you think that this is emblematic of, you know, how European countries are dealing with refugees and migration? Or do you think Spain is like a one-off case here?
No, I think it is incredibly emblematic. There are specifics to the Spain case, however. I mean, the general public, when looking at numerous surveys, they were generally more open to refugees and migrants, but it didn't really help hinder the emergence of Vox, especially within southern Spain, to really gain power and gain some traction. But I mean, we've seen these kind of populist parties rising within the last, you know, few years, really. I mean, everyone really hints at Trump and the Brexit crisis and the Brexit deal that's been going on as like the most preeminent examples of this. But I mean, Spain is a perfect example of how it creeps in even in smaller regional issues and in areas where you wouldn't really think it would occur. And it will see across many of our own case studies, including France, Germany, with many upcoming elections within the next few years. And I think it'll be very interesting to see.
We are very quickly running out of time. I would strongly recommend anybody who wants to read more about this to just look at our report and, you know, go through it. We will also hopefully have an executive summary by the time this podcast is out. After Zach, I will give you the stage for some concluding remarks. Achter, vous êtes francophone, would you perhaps like to deliver your closing remarks in French?
Avec plaisir. Voilà, j'aimerais remercier énormément mes deux collègues, Keshav et Zach, pour ce travail qui a été vraiment passionnant d'un point de vue personnel et d'un point de vue aussi de la dynamique d'équipe. La Geneva Peace Building Platform qui nous a aussi beaucoup aidé, l'Institut des hautes études internationales et du développement. Voilà, je vous encourage aussi à lire notre report et voilà, c'était un plaisir de participer à cette discussion. Et j'espère prendre part à d'autres discussions de la même engeance dans le futur. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, Arthur. Zach, please go ahead.
Just to go off, Arthur, for maybe some of our non-francophone listeners, just thank you again to the Graduate Institute. Thank you to the Peace Building Platform. Special thank you to all of those that we interviewed. You all were incredible, and we thank you so much for your knowledge and insight and for taking the time to speak with us. This report was absolutely amazing to work on with Arthur and Keisha.
And that is it for this episode of Peace in a Pod. Thank you so much for tuning in and making it to the very end of this episode. If you want to read the full report, you can find that in our show notes along with some very interesting research papers on this subject. Thank you once again and hope you're all staying safe, indoors and healthy. Until next time, bye-bye.